Khrushchev, soldiers in Vietnam, all in rapid succession. 5 frames per image. Extremely fast for 1964. Even a little shocking today. It ends with the title cards Anyone for Survival and End. That last card may have been a portentous step too far, but there it was. America at the tipping point of the 1960s. Anxiety over war and racism. The emotion behind that year's big protest anthem, Eve of Destruction, all within a single minute of film. The result was a hit with faculty and went on to win a total of 18 awards at student festivals around the world. Lucas's confidence exploded in an instant. When I did that film, I realized I was able to run circles around everyone else, he said. That's when I realized these crazy ideas I had might work. 8. The Moviola. After Look at Life, Lucas went to town on class projects. For lighting class, he and classmate Paul Golding produced a simple meditation on the hood of a car. Set to Miles Davis's Basin Street Blues, it was called Herbie, for the mistaken belief that Herbie Hancock played piano on the track. Hypnotic shots of neon diffusing over chrome were cut to the music. At the snap of a drum you saw, for a second, something that looked like a galaxy being born. Lucas had the chance to meet and take a class from the mighty French director, Jean-Luc Godard. After that, he seemed to have had the zeal of a convert about New Wave cinema and the auteur theory. By the time of his third short, Freiheit, the story of a young man, played by Kleiser, escaping across the border between East and West Germany, played by Southern California scrubland, Lucas had veered so far into the avant-garde that he was experimenting with dropping his first name. A film by Lucas, says the title card. The primary film editing machine at the time, the upright Moviola, seemed custom-built for a car-loving youth. It had gears and sprockets, it needed to be greased, and it growled. Foot pedals controlled speed and motion. Lucas had to break into the editing room, known as the bullpen, so he could drive the film all night, cutting a scene just a hair's breadth before he got bored with it. The whole session fueled by Hershey bars, Cokes, and coffee. He gave himself the supremely geeky nickname Super Editor. For his graduation project, 1 hour, 42 minutes, 8 seconds, A Man and His Car, Lucas brought his 2 main loves together, fast cars and fast films. It was technically excellent, but cold. You didn't see much of the man. Its soundtrack was the roar of the engine. He'd been inspired by another National Film Board of Canada film called 12 Bicycles, which used the same kind of long lenses Lucas would employ in 1 hour, 42 minutes, 8 seconds. Lucas used color film, which students were theoretically barred from using, and took more than a semester to complete the project, another breach of the rules. He was dressed down for breaking into the bullpen and editing at night. The faculty may have grumbled, but Lucas was basically untouchable at this stage. The award-winning Wunderkind had attracted a coterie of student friends, which became known, in retrospect at least, as the Dirty Dozen. At one end of the spectrum was John Milius, girl-chasing, outlandish, conservative, militaristic, a man who would have joined the Marines but for his asthma. At the other end was Walter Murch, a refined East Coast intellectual. Murch first met Lucas when the young savant told Murch he was developing film all wrong. That kind of approach didn't seem to stunt relationships in a school that was all about meritocracy. If you saw an exciting film, said Murch, you became friends with the guy who made it. Both Milius and Murch would come to have an indirect effect on Star Wars, but Milius's impact was the most immediate. He insisted on taking Lucas to see the samurai films of the Japanese director Akira Kurosawa that played at the Toho Cinema on La Brea in Los Angeles. Kurosawa had turned Milius's life around when he'd been declared 4F. A week-long festival of Kurosawa's movies had convinced him to apply to film school. Lucas only had to see Seven Samurai once to know he was hooked. Kurosawa shared his love of long lenses and wide shots. He told irresistible stories that built slowly to a grand conclusion. He loved to build the audience's anticipation for something that was about to happen, something just off the edge of the screen. And there was something more in those samurai films, something that would have been obvious to any child of the 1950s. Kurosawa loved westerns. Asked once where he received his inspiration, the Japanese director responded, "I study John Ford." Ford, the multiple Oscar-winning director of movies such as The Searchers and The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance, is considered the past master of the westerns. Although born to an Irish family in Maine, Ford was able to find and frame the spirit of the American West. His characters struggled against vast, rugged terrain, reached for far horizons, and spoke only when necessary. Kurosawa translated Ford's westerns to medieval Japan. Star Wars would owe significant debts to both directors. Lucas may have taken a circuitous foreign route to the western influences that would show up on Tatooine, but was hardly impoverished for doing so. It was like learning about American rock and roll by listening to the Beatles. 9. Government work. On graduating in August 1966, Lucas got the draft letter he'd been expecting. The Vietnam War was sucking an entire generation into the major maelstrom of the Cold War. He considered following the exodus to Canada. Friends who had been drafted had weighed that option, but thought better of it when they heard back from homesick classmates. The best Lucas could hope for was officer candidate school, perhaps leading to assignment with a military filmmaking unit. When he reported for medical inspection, however, Lucas got a nasty shock. He was diabetic. Not only did that rate him 4F, but he also had to quit his constant companions, Hershey bars and Cokes. John Plummer said Lucas compared the diagnosis, once it was confirmed by his doctor back in Modesto, to a second car crash. But it was to give him a heroic dose of self-discipline and a leg up on his contemporaries. Desperate to outrun the need for insulin injections, he would remain substance-free for the rest of his career. No smoking, no drugs, no sugar, barely any drinking. Such choices would set him apart from many other filmmakers of his generation, and not in a bad way. In 1977, the year the first Star Wars film was released, Martin Scorsese admitted he was too coked up to face the challenge of making much-needed changes to the disastrous New York, New York. Francis Coppola sat amid a haze of pot smoke on the horrifically over-budget, long-delayed Apocalypse Now, while friends feared for his sanity. Meanwhile, Lucas, boring old Mr. Clean, churned out the year's top movie on a tight budget, then turned around and started its sequel. Since he was spared from military service, Lucas's next obvious step was USC graduate school, but he was too late to apply for the fall. While he waited for the next year's admissions process to begin, he cut movie reels for the U.S. Information Agency, working in the living room of editor Verna Fields. This first taste of professional movie making forced Lucas to rethink his aspirations. After being told that he'd made a story about a crackdown on an anti-government riot in South Korea look too fascist, he had an epiphany. He didn't want to be an editor. He wanted to be the one telling the editors what to do. His year off from school afforded Lucas another revelation. Fields hired a second editor to work alongside him. Her name was Marcia Griffin. She was as shy and willful as Lucas, and they had both been born in Modesto. Griffin was a military brat from a nearby base. "Neither one of us would take any shit from the other," Lucas said. They began to date, and it didn't take long for George to start telling Marcia about an idea he had for a space fantasy. "That damn movie was whirring through the editing machine in George's head on the day we met," she would say 2 decades later, from the other end of a bitter divorce. "He never doubted it would get made. He spent a lot of his time thinking of ways to get those spaceships and creatures on the screen." Those spaceships and creatures were to change her life forever too, and not necessarily for the better. 10. THX 1138 4EB. The dream of spaceships and space soldiers seems to have been entangled with the dream of an easier-to-make movie, more science fiction than space fantasy, whirring through the editing machine in Lucas's head. Walter Murch and another classmate, Matthew Robbins, had come up with a treatment for what was originally called Breakout, a man escaping from an underground lair in a dystopian future. Lucas loved the concept. How to make it, though? He wasn't in film school at the time. He didn't have access to equipment, and he certainly couldn't afford to buy any on his own. But these obstacles were surmountable with a little bit of lateral thinking. Lucas realized that if he took a second job as a teaching assistant in a USC class for Navy cadets, USC trained military filmmakers in return for the lease on the barracks, he would have access to their color film. He organized the Navy guys into two teams, framing the class as a competition to see who could shoot a film with the best natural lighting. He took charge of one team. His guys had access to military installations. Hey, presto! Instant film crew, instant locations. It wouldn't have failed to remind Lucas of Jean-Luc Godard's own strange dystopian film, Alphaville, A Strange Adventure of Lemmy Caution, 1965, filmed in the strangest, most fascist-looking locations he could find around Paris. THX-1138-4EB was the name Lucas gave to the uncut feature he loaded up on the Moviola at Verna Field's house some weeks later. It would take him 12 weeks of late-night editing to finish it. THX was pronounced Thex, and appears to have been a joking reference to sex, though Lucas had trouble persuading anyone other than his closest friends to say it that way. The EB stood for Earthborn. A year later, when the film was wowing audiences at student film festivals, he amended the title. Another signature Lucas move, adding Electric Labyrinth. The result was light years beyond the average student film. Lucas and Murch had warped the sound, making much of the dialogue deliberately unintelligible. All the audience needed to understand was that THX 1138 is a man on the run from some sort of Orwellian government security apparatus. Not much acting was required. THX is seen in close-up for only a second. The surveillance guys hunting him are supposed to be dispassionate, which the Navy guys found easy. One wears a numbered helmet that covers his eyes while he pulls levers. The first embryonic stormtrooper Lucas committed to film. The major innovation in the movie is what Lucas did in the optical lab, adding numbers and captions to the film, almost at random. He points his camera at TV screens. An organ drones deep, discordant notes in the background. Viewers feel like voyeurs, ghosts in the government machine. Today, it feels like it's full of student film cliché, but Lucas practically invented those clichés. Not only did the short win armfuls of awards, but it also won him his first appearance in Time magazine in February 1968. Lucas babbled to the interviewer that THX's pursuers have a whole backstory, that they are two separate races of Erosbods and Clinicbods. Suddenly, Lucas the Odd Bod was making all sorts of interesting friends with this award-winning film as his calling card. THX was not of this earth, said a Long Beach film student who was introduced to Lucas at a student screening that included Lucas's completed short, Steven Spielberg. It was to be another decade before they became collaborators, but they were already well on the way to becoming each other's biggest fans. THX created a world that did not exist before George designed it, Spielberg enthused. That may be overselling the 15-minute version of THX somewhat. It's a chase film, says Charlie Lippincott flatly. It's about paranoia. But however you define it, the fact remains that Lucas managed to put a nightmarish future on film years before Hollywood started doing the same thing. The film industry would produce a slate of sour science fiction features in the 1970s, such as Omega Man in 1971, Soylent Green in 1973, Logan's Run in 1976. Lucas was to effectively launch that slate with the feature version of THX, and he would effectively bring it to an end with Star Wars. 11. The Emperor. Lucas re-entered USC as a graduate student in Triumph, a 15-minute color film in the can. No other student had ever done such a thing. For an encore, he would crank out his first graduate film on an even tighter schedule, learning just how fast he could push himself. Anyone Lived in a Pretty Howe Town was a 5-minute confection named for an E.E. Cummings poem. The plot, a photographer, makes his subjects disappear. That's it. Like most of Lucas's student shorts, it featured no dialogue and felt a little inhuman. And you weren't sure how deliberate all of that was. The final film Lucas shot as a student, The Emperor, was different. For the first time, Lucas focused his lens on a human subject. Burbank radio DJ Bob Hudson, the self-styled Emperor of Radio. It was an interesting choice, and not because the name would be echoed in the prime mover of evil in the Star Wars movies. Hudson was a self-confessed fantasist. He opened the short by talking about Emperor Norton, an eccentric character in 19th century San Francisco, who declared himself emperor and began to be treated as such. Hudson took the example to heart with his grandiose title. Lucas evidently warmed to this notion, someone becoming exactly what he wanted to be, no matter how outrageous it sounded. Like Norton, Hudson declared it and then lived it. This was to become Lucas's philosophy too. Dream yourself an empire. As corny as it sounds, Lucas declared years later, the power of positive thinking goes a long way. Perhaps because of such eccentric grandiosity, Hudson got himself ejected from a steady stream of stations. I'm disagreeable, he tells the camera, though we only see his whimsicality. These days, Hudson would be an AM radio shock jock. He had the look and the loose mouth of a Rush Limbaugh. But in the 1960s, radio voices were more benign. They played records, told stories and jokes, kept you company. Lucas had fun with the format, and viewers of his films got a strong sense of his oddball humor in The Emperor for the first time. He put the credits in the exact middle of the movie, right before the punchline of one of Hudson's jokes. It's fantasy, Hudson says at the end of the movie, echoing the title card at the beginning. Radio is fantasy. He fades out, leaving an empty chair. Film was fantasy too. That's what Lucas learned at USC. Film was fantasy. Your fantasies could appear on film. And he had the potential to spin that fantasy, to drive that moviola like no other filmmaker. Well, almost no other. 12. Francis Ford Coppola. After Lucas graduated, he retreated into the desert. Lippincott had turned down a $200-a-week scholarship offered by Columbia Pictures to work on a western called McKenna's Gold that was being shot in Arizona, and Lucas took the gig instead. But he became angry at the scholarship, which he later called a ruse to get a bunch of cheap behind-the-scenes documentaries. Lucas pocketed the cash, withdrew from the shoot, and made a documentary about the desert itself. Still in love with numbers, he called it 6-18-67, for the day he finished shooting. Exactly one decade later, Lucas would be reaping the first rewards of a far more difficult desert shoot. The next opportunity was another scholarship, one that Lucas won on the strength of THX, and Murch lost, but not before they'd made a pact that the winner would help out the loser. This one gave Lucas 6 months at Warner Brothers at $80 a week. Later, Lucas would spin the fantasy that his first day on the lot was Jack Warner's last. In fact, Warner would stick around, on and off, for years. But the studio was in a bad way, sold to a business consortium. Many of its departments shuttered. One that was in the process of closing was the animation department, home of Looney Tunes, which is where Lucas had wanted to spend his scholarship time. Prior to the scholarship, Lucas had tried and failed to get a job at Hanna-Barbera. He had briefly assisted animator Saul Bass on the Oscar-winning short Why Man Creates. It would take Lucas until 2008 to succeed in becoming a producer of animated fare, having taken the long way round. Instead, Lucas picked up the phone in the moribund animation department and made a fateful call to his classmate Howard Kazanjian, who happened to be on the lot as assistant director on the only movie then in production, a musical called Finian's Rainbow. Kazanjian told Lucas to come on down so he could introduce him to Francis Ford Coppola, a self-confident wunderkind from UCLA, the only student filmmaker in the country whose star had eclipsed Lucas's. After a spell working for B-movie maestro Roger Corman, Coppola had landed a Hollywood directing gig. That alone seemed impossible. But the fact that he just happened to be on the Warner's lot at the same time Lucas was despairing of something to do? That had to be destiny. Coppola found room in the budget for Lucas to work as an assistant, and their ever-lively relationship was off to the races. Coppola challenged Lucas to come up with a brilliant idea for the film every day. Lucas delivered, but Coppola, 4 years his senior, still teased his charge mercilessly, calling him a stinky kid. Lucas's second lifelong mentor after his father was also, he said, his tormentor. They were polar opposites, loud and quiet, impetuous and cautious, womanizing and distantly devoted. Lucas once said his career was a reaction to Coppola's as much as anything else. Still, the two had something crucial in common. George broke the rules at USC, Kazanjian would later observe. After all, he literally broke into the editing bullpen. Francis likes breaking rules. On late nights, back at the office with Kazanjian, Lucas and Coppola kept talking about how much they hated the Hollywood scene and wanted to tear down its stodgy structure of unions and old guard studio bosses. So it was another extraordinary stroke of luck when Coppola got the go-ahead from the studio to film his screenplay, The Rain People. He put together a 20-person road shoot, a caravan across America on a shoestring budget, all handheld cameras and motels. The movie's heroine was doing a Kerouac, going on the road to find herself. The young filmmakers were doing the same. Lucas came along as a jack-of-all-trades. He would record sound, carry equipment, manage props. He filmed a documentary that captured Coppola's tempestuousness, as well as the fun and chaos of the road trip, with fireworks being shot from car to car, their drivers wearing Prussian military helmets. Around this time, Lucas was captured on documentary film cameras himself for the first time, for a segment of a short on new filmmakers that was ostensibly focused on Coppola. Introduced as the director's assistant, no, insists Coppola, his associate. Lucas smiles shyly and looks down at his camera. Then the film cuts to Lucas in thick-framed glasses, the beginnings of a goatee, and a Mao-style military jacket in full revolutionary flow. Student films are the only real hope, he lectures. I think they, the studios, are starting to realize that students know what they're doing. You know, they're not just a bunch of silly kids playing around. The creator-to-be, the self-determined emperor of film, was about to become much more than a silly kid playing in an alleyway. But first, he would have to learn to write. 5. How to be a Jedi. The god of the state was a lie. Our hero was determined to find the truth behind all religions. There must be something independent, said THX 1138. A force. Lucas wrote those lines in 1968 as he was adapting THX 1138 for EB into what would be his first ever feature film. The echo from Arthur Lipset's 2187 could still be heard. Sometime in the following year, he decided to cut the Force scene from his THX script. But the Force would continue to flow through him, demanding to be born as a concept. In 1977, it would explode into the minds of millions. Thereafter, Francis Ford Coppola suggested to Lucas that the two of them actually start a religion using the Force as its scripture. Lucas feared for his friend's sanity, but it wasn't out of character for Coppola, a man who once joked that he was modeling his career on Hitler's rise to power, and who, Lucas often said, had a habit of finding a parade and jumping out in front to lead it. Even if Coppola had his tongue in his cheek, it wasn't an unprecedented idea. Science fiction writer L. Ron Hubbard had by then spent 3 decades building his religion, the Church of Scientology. Lucas has more adherents than Hubbard could ever have dreamed of. If he had let the charismatic Coppola build a church of Forceology, there seems little doubt we'd be living in a different world. But Lucas's intent in the movies had been to distill religious beliefs that were already in existence, not to add a new one. Knowing that the film was made for a young audience, I was trying to say, in a simple way, that there is a God and that there is both a good side and a bad side, Lucas told his biographer, Dale Pollack. You have a choice between them, but the world works better if you're on the good side. The Force is so basic a concept as to be universally appealing, a religion for the secular age that is so well suited to our times precisely because it is so bereft of detail. Everyone gets to add their own layers of meaning. Lucas, through a long process of trial and error, seems to have deliberately encouraged viewers' unique interpretations. The more detail I went into, the more it detracted from the concept I was trying to put forward, Lucas recalled in 1997. So the real essence was to deal with the Force, but not be too specific about it. In Star Wars, Obi-Wan Kenobi explains the Force to Luke Skywalker in just 28 well-chosen words. The Force is what gives a Jedi his power. It is an energy field created by all living things. It surrounds us, penetrates us. It binds the galaxy together. Other than that, the Force is largely a mystery. We learn that it has a strong influence on the weak-minded, that there is a dark side of the Force that seduced Darth Vader. We know that Vader believes the Force to be far superior to the technological power of the Death Star, and that he can use it to choke people he disagrees with from across a room. Luke is taught to let go your conscious mind and reach out with your feelings. He is told the Force will be with you always. Han Solo believes the Force to be a hokey religion, no substitute for a good blaster, but later grudgingly wishes for the Force to be with Luke. Obi-Wan disappears when Vader's lightsaber strikes him. Audiences presume this had something to do with the Force, but it was left unexplained for 5 more movies. Luke was able to destroy the Death Star because he puts his targeting computer aside and relies on the Force. You might just as well call it intuition. And that's all he wrote. Lucas, at least. The explanation provided by Jedi Master Yoda in the next movie, much of it written by Lawrence Kasdan rather than Lucas, may have been more poetic, more spiritual. Luminous beings are we, not this crude matter. And more demonstrative. Yoda lifts an X-Wing fighter out of a swamp after explaining that the Force is connected to all things. But we learn little more from this than we did from Kenobi's 28 words. Indeed, later attempts to examine the Force in more detail seemed out of keeping with the movie's space fantasy origins. The moment Lucas decided to add a kind of rational, scientific component to Jedi knowledge of the Force in Episode 1, the infamous midichlorians, microscopic organisms that are supposed to help the Force bind to living beings, long-time fans revolted. It didn't matter that, as Lucasfilm protested, the midichlorians are not supposed to be what the Force is actually made of, just a biological indication of its presence. If you dig deep enough into the Lucasfilm archives, you'll find Lucas talking about midichlorians as early as August 1977. It is said that certain creatures are born with a higher awareness of the Force than others, he said during a role-playing exercise designed to help him flesh out Star Wars concepts after the original movie. Their brains are different. They have more midichlorians in their cells. This didn't matter either. What fans actually want, it seems, is as little detail as possible. They want 28 words and nothing more. Lucas, by that stage, may have been trying to use his powers for the good of science education. As much is suggested by the midichlorians' homonymity with mitochondria, the energy source for most of our cells. That's commendable, but if we want to see the Force of the movies manifest in real life, you have to look to religion and art, not biology. The Force is a Navajo prayer, an echo of a commitment in an art house film, and many more things besides. The grandest form of active force, from Tao come their only source, says the Tao Te Ching. The Tao, like the force, is the basis for a form of martial arts. So are the concepts of qi or energy prevalent in traditional Chinese Buddhist culture and prana in India, Sanskrit for life force. The force is all of these things. It is none of them. The force has been embraced by Jews and Hindus and Wiccans. Everyone sees what they want to see in it, especially if, like those kids watching Flash Gordon, they first encountered the force at the right age. Just how widely the force has been embraced by people from different walks of life became clear in 2004 when Dr. Jennifer Porter, a religious studies professor from the Memorial University of Newfoundland, conducted a survey at a Disney World Star Wars weekend. When I was 12, something about that universal connection to the force really grabbed something within me, said one Jewish respondent. That and the concept of the Jedi respecting and protecting all life and developing mind, body, and soul reflected my own path in life. From that point, I made it my personal journey to become a Jedi. I wasn't counting on being able to move objects with my mind, and the thought of creating a true functioning lightsaber didn't even cross my mind. But I did seek to control my emotions, to be more aware of the consequences of my actions, to honor and respect all life in both people and creatures, and to find peace and serenity and beauty in everything around me. That was a surprisingly representative sentiment. The theme that emerges most strongly in the comments, says Porter, is that of the force as a metaphor for godhood that resonates and inspires within them a deeper commitment to the godhood identified within their traditional faith. In other words, the force is like an Instagram filter through which to view any established religion. It isn't oppositional enough to even appear to attempt to supplant any traditional religion, the way John Lennon had his brief flirtation with the notion that the Beatles had more active supporters than Christianity. The force is friendly and enhancing to all. Therefore, the force conquers all. Christianity could easily have set itself up in opposition to a theology that appeared to embrace Eastern culture. Instead, for the most part, except for isolated locations like Albin Johnson's Sunday School, Christians embraced the force. It was ethereal enough to be construed as the Holy Spirit. May the force be with you sounded an awful lot like the Dominus Vobiscum of traditional liturgy. The Lord be with you. Star Wars producer Gary Kurtz remembers that comparison was exactly the intention. Indeed, the earliest attempt to layer a contemporary earthly religion over the Force, one of the earliest books written on Star Wars period, was a Christian one. In 1977, Frank Allnutt, a former Disney publicist, he worked on Mary Poppins, turned evangelist, rushed out a book called The Force of Star Wars. Rather than being an escape from reality, Allnutt wrote, Star Wars was a signpost to something more real. It says to the viewer, listen, there's something better in life than wallowing in the mud of pornography, dope, materialism, and vain philosophies. You have a higher calling, a calling to be somebody, to do something. You have a date with destiny. You have potential in you that you haven't begun to develop. There is a force in the universe that you need to be plugged into. Lucas was pointing toward Jesus, Allnutt wrote, perhaps unknowingly. He said that when Kenobi talked about the force, his eyes sparkled like he was talking about a dear old friend, not an impersonal force. He compared Kenobi's sacrificial moment of death to the crucifixion. In later years, Allnutt would refine his philosophy, pointing out that Jedi could be a contraction of Jesus' disciple. Allnutt's book became an instant bestseller and resonated with both fans and the broader Christian community. When I mentioned Allnutt's book to Albin Johnson, he laughed nostalgically. I devoured that book, he said. It was plain English enough that I followed along. I must have read it 3 times. It allowed young Albin to reconcile Star Wars with his parents' Christian faith and made him resolve to stick it out and harbor a secret love for Star Wars. Lucas himself was never much of a Christian, as much as he had been raised Methodist. He certainly carried around a concept of God. I'm simply struggling through life, trying to do God's bidding, he told Dale Pollack in 1982. but his use of the G word diminished in later years as his views evolved. In 1999, Lucas was told by the dean of the Graduate School of Journalism at UC Berkeley, "You sound awfully Buddhist to me," Lucas responded. "My daughter was asked at school, 'What are you?' And she said, 'We're Buddhist Methodists.' I said, 'Well, I guess that's one way to describe it.'" A few years later, he elaborated to Time magazine, "I was raised Methodist. Now let's say I'm spiritual. It's Marin County. We're all Buddhists up here." Indeed, Lucas's longtime assistant, Jane Bay, is a dedicated follower of the Dalai Lama and has written books about her experiences of traveling to Tibet, adopting a daughter there, and then dealing with the grief of losing her. Much of what we learn of the Jedi in the prequel trilogy follows this part Christian, part Buddhist theme. We see an order similar to the Knights Templar or celibate warrior monks. We hear a lot about non-attachment, a key Buddhist tenet. We learn that anger leads to hate. Hate leads to suffering. Suffering being the result of all attachment, according to the Buddha. Anakin Skywalker becomes a fallen angel, the satanic Vader. But this biblical downfall happens because he is too attached to the idea of defeating death and saving his wife. The prequels complicate our notion not just of the Force, but of the Jedi Knights themselves. We see the Jedi in repose, in what looks like prayer or meditation, depending on your point of view. But we also see an order that is too rigid, an order destroyed, like the Templar, because it was dragged into war by its attachment to being guardians of peace. Everything in the original trilogy tells us the way of the Jedi is the last hope of the galaxy, but everything in the prequels tells us the Jedi themselves had flaws that were all too human. It's as if Lucas built a religion by accident and then decided to tear it down at its foundations. At the same time as Lucas was making the prequels, a grassroots effort to create a kind of Jedi church was underway, but in a far less serious sense than you might think. In February 2001, New Zealand was 1 week away from its usual once-a-decade census. Someone in the country, anonymous to this day, took a look at question 18, which dealt with religious affiliation, and saw a chance to have some fun. "We're trying to encourage people to tick the other box and then fill their religion in as Jedi," said an anonymous email. "All Star Wars fans will understand." The writer claimed falsely that the country would be forced to recognize Jediism as an official religion. His or her second objective: it's a bit of an experiment in the power of email. It's safe to say the experiment succeeded. With 1 week's notice, some 53,715 New Zealanders ticked the other box and wrote in Jedi. The government refused to recognize it as an affiliation, but unofficially, Jedi became the country's second largest religion. For the census in Australia that August, the same email was overhauled. This time, it was claimed 10,000 was the official barrier to a new religion. There was a new incentive. "Remember, if you are a member of the Jedi religion, then you are by default a Jedi Knight." In some versions, there was a coda: "If this has been your dream since you were 4 years old, do it because you love Star Wars. If not, do it out of badness." The Australian government struck back, warning that anyone who went to the dark side by putting a false answer on a census form was liable for a penalty of $1,000. Though the idea of the government issuing a fine to any or all of the self-declared Jedi beggars believe, census officials were in earnest. For a group to be included in the Australian Bureau of Statistics classification of religion, it would have to show that there was an underlying belief system or philosophy, said Hugh McGaw, of the Census Processing and User Services. Some 70,000 Australians risked the fine and wrote in Jedi anyway, perhaps in the hope that someone would come along and reveal that underlying belief system. Nobody was ever fined. New Zealand and Australia were just the beginning. Jediism spread to Canada, courtesy of a couple of DJs in Vancouver. 21,000 Canadians wrote it in their census. Subsequent counts in Croatia, the Czech Republic, and Montenegro all found thousands of Jedi living in their country. Ireland has refused to divulge how many Jedi live on the Emerald Isle. But the all-time prize for the Jedi chain mailers was the United Kingdom, which reported more than 400,000 Jedi within its borders, after the government made it clear that nobody would be fined for writing it in, and indeed embraced it as a method to increase census response rates among teens and 20-somethings. Those 400,000 respondents represented 0.7% of the population, making Jedi the United Kingdom's fourth largest stated religion after Christianity, Islam, and Hinduism. So far, so amusing. But how much of this was a real reflection of the spread of Jediism, rather than just done to annoy officialdom, or to make a point about having to put your religion on your census form? Turns out, not so much. Consider that in the 2001 census, 14.7% of the United Kingdom put down no religion. For Star Wars-loving atheists and agnostics, Jedi may be simply a more interesting personal statement than no religion. Consider also that the largest percentages of Jedi in the United Kingdom seem to live in major college towns. Brighton, Oxford, and Cambridge all had roughly 2% Jedi. Much of the response was essentially a student prank. Still, there followed an onslaught of Jedi headlines. Politicians found they could get attention by latching on to the notion of a Jedi religion. In 2006, Labour's Jamie Reid used his maiden speech in Parliament to declare himself the first Jedi MP. His office confirmed that this was a joke. He was trying to prove that religion, in the context of a parliamentary bill on hate crimes, was a hard thing to define. But the headlines didn't hurt, nor did they for a conservative MP who brought up a possible Jedi exclusion to a religion bill in 2009. Ordinary UK residents also made the news by claiming affiliation with the Jedi. A couple of Londoners calling themselves Jedi delivered a petition to the United Nations Association calling for the forthcoming UN International Day of Tolerance to be renamed the UN Interstellar Day of Tolerance. The Daily Mail couldn't resist doing a photo feature. Then in 2009 in Bangor, North Wales, a man named Daniel Jones was asked to remove his hoodie in a Tesco supermarket. He claimed he was the founder of the International Church of Jediism with 500,000 followers worldwide. Newspapers reported this without comment. In fact, Jones's church has little more than 500 followers on Twitter. "It states in our Jedi doctrination, Sikh, that I can wear headwear," Jones said, after he had presented the Tesco manager with a church business card and was ejected. A Tesco spokesman put his best spin on the incident. "If Jedi walk around our stores with their hoods on, they'll miss lots of special offers." The closest thing one can find to a Church of Jediism is the website JediChurch.org. This international umbrella group currently claims 6,300 members on Facebook. That may be the same size as the 501st Legion, but the group has none of the 501st's coherence. The content is largely the same as any Facebook group. Jokes, news items, inspirational images, the occasional political cause. A member writes that they're getting the Jedi Code as a tattoo. Someone posts a quote from the Dalai Lama. Another posts a video of lightsaber twirling. Yet another updates us on a unicycling Darth Vader in Portland, Oregon, who plays flaming bagpipes. More power to them all. But having a fun Facebook group does not a religious order make. The Wikipedia page on Jediism says it all. Jediism has no founder or central structure. Imagine a religion with no religion. As Lucas's third mentor, Joseph Campbell, put it, "All religions are true. None are literal." The number of Jedi in censuses since 2001 has also risen and mostly fallen. In her research, Jennifer Porter draws a distinction between Jedi realists, who call themselves Jedi but reject the religion label and prefer to think of Jediism as a philosophy of life, and Jediists, who claim to follow an entirely new creed. Some Jediists claim to follow something called the 21 Maxims. Prowess, justice, loyalty, defense, courage, and I'll spare you the rest. Gleaned from the now inactive website Jediism.org. Porter estimates that there are at least five times more Jedi realists than Jediists. There was an ideological power struggle, she says, and the Jediists got stomped. That sounds about right. The Jedi I've encountered are very postmodern about the whole thing. Things are just as one Presbyterian respondent to Porter's survey wrote, I suspect that all or most of these Jedi are not really practicing the faith they profess to believe in anyway. They just want cool lightsabers. I can't seem to spin my lightsaber forward. This is a problem. Spinning your lightsaber forward is the first thing you learn in lightsaber class. If I can't master this basic move, my training will be limited indeed. Elaine Block, our instructor, is doing his best to show us. Looking the part in robes, long leather Jedi boots, and feathered hair a la Anakin Skywalker, he points out what he's doing in the studio mirrors. Forward spin, thumb and forefinger. Forward, open up your palm. Palms open out. My wrist doesn't want to turn like that. I can't even see how his is turning. It's a blur. Just let the momentum of the blade carry you through the spin. Now you can go a bit faster. Regardless of my poor ability, the class moves on. Soon we're practicing spinning our sabers backward, slashing them in figure eights with each hand and whipping them out from behind our backs. Block has Star Wars soundtracks playing in the background, accompanied by the occasional echoing clunk as another lightsaber falls to the floor. We're at the regular Sunday afternoon meeting of the Golden Gate Knights, a 3-hour Jedi training school held in a dance studio steps from the startups of San Francisco's South of Market neighborhood. Block's 2-year-old class was featured on the websites of the BBC and Los Angeles Times. Then the BBC turned to him for comment when a Scottish clergyman expressed fears that the disestablishment of marriage in the UK would lead to people being married by a Jedi. Block declined to contribute. He's a Jedi realist. All of it is rather crap, he says of Jediist tracks. I tell people just go to the source. Buddhism, Taoism, Hinduism, whatever. Because all of the pseudo-religious philosophy in Star Wars is just that. I found a surprisingly diverse crowd in Block's class. About as many women as men, young as old, Caucasian as not. There was a healthy stream of couples on dates, gay and straight. Every week, we had visitors from foreign climes. One guy came all the way from Madrid. It turned out he had started leading a similar class there. If you want a snapshot of the Star Wars audience, it's right here. It looks like everyone. Lightsabers, in short, are a global obsession. There's an annual worldwide contest for the best lightsaber video on YouTube called Saber Comp. The results are spectacular and well worth looking up. In Germany, I met the Saber Project, a large and earnest group of fluorescent lightsaber makers that performed a mass battle demonstration before a 30th anniversary screening of Return of the Jedi. In 2013, Harvard and MIT scientists were able to bind together tiny molecules made out of photons. Scientists create lightsaber technology, the headlines screamed. In Shanghai, one company has gone so far as to sell an extremely powerful handheld laser as a lightsaber. It might not be able to slice off someone's arm and cauterize the wound, but it will certainly take your eye out. But who wouldn't want the chance, at least once, to swing something you can convince yourself is a real lightsaber? The sabers the Golden Gate Knights use are a vast improvement over the $10 telescoping kind found in Toys R Us. Block offers blades in abundance, all custom-built by groups similar to the Saber Project, as well as assorted online individuals. Each handle has a different style, a different grip, a well-honed metal sheen. They emit just the right hum. Some are modified with accelerometers and impact sensors and make the famed clashing sound when they meet. A tough translucent tube houses a beam from a powerful fluorescent LED. It's enough to feel there's a laser blade in front of you when the lights are on, and to make everyone in the class go, ooh, when the studio lights are dimmed and the mirrors reflect our blades into infinity. The easiest way to describe lightsaber class is that it's one part fencing, one part yoga. The goal is to learn a numbered system of fight choreography worked out by Block and his co-founder, Matthew Caruto, who runs the same class in his studio in Silicon Valley. You and I could meet for the first time with our lightsabers at a Comic-Con, say, and I could utter a string of numbers, and you would know that I was going to slice around your body in a star formation and parry appropriately. We could even throw in flourishes such as the figure eight, or something more elaborate Block calls the Obi-Ani, but which is actually a move called Plum Blossom from the martial art Wushu. We would, for one moment, shed our nerd shells. We would look cool. It's a far cry from the rolled-up newspaper and zoom, zoom noises my friends and I would employ as kids. I was delighted to learn that everyone, even Ewan McGregor and Liam Neeson, when they began training with sticks for their lightsaber battles in Episode 1, makes the noises when they start out. As kids in the 80s, Block and his friends would battle with flashlights in darkened rooms. "We had our rules about it," he says. "Usually we would have to stop and decide if someone had blocked the blade in time. I suspect we spent more time refereeing the fights than actually fighting." Block came to learn the way of the lightsaber after an unusual experience at the annual Burning Man Festival in Nevada in 2006. One attendee, in an act of the kind of bizarre generosity that permeates the event, handed out 10,000 lightsabers with the instructions to meet at sunset for an epic battle royale. Two sides, each 100 strong, charged at each other in the middle of the desert in the nerd version of a giant pillow fight. The experience changed Block. He felt inspired to start walking the streets of San Francisco dressed as a Jedi. One day in Dolores Park, the palm tree mecca of the Mission District, a man came up to him and said, "I see you have two lightsabers." Block, who indeed was carrying two lightsabers for the first time, red and blue, Sith and Jedi, said, "Yes, I do." "Well," said the man thoughtfully, "we should do battle then." And battle they did. Block came armed with rules. If you touched the other guy's torso three times with the lightsaber, you won. Later, Block met another man at a party who challenged him to a duel and asked if he remembered the epic battle royale at Burning Man. This was Hib Engler, the guy who handed out 10,000 lightsabers in the first place. They fought twice. Both men won a duel. The circle was complete. Block tried to brush up his skills through fencing class, stage combat class, and martial arts, but nothing on offer was quite like being trained to use a lightsaber. Finally, Block found Caruto through a YouTube video demonstrating his technique and his custom sabers. Caruto gave Block one lesson, and Block said, "You know, people would pay to do this." He found the studio and started to prove himself right. The guy from Dolores Park was one of the first. 2 years on, Block estimates he's had nearly 1,000 students. The suggested donation, ahem, Lucasfilm, is $10. A few more lightsaber spinning exercises, doing a reverse figure eight behind your back, letting the lightsaber leap from hand to hand, and then we move into the fight choreography. "First, chamber your attack," Block says, meaning pull the blade into your side, held with two hands. Always hold your lightsaber with two hands unless you're doing a spin or flourish. Pointed up and ready. Then swing at your opponent, pivoting the handle with your higher leading hand at its fulcrum, using the back of the blade as a lever with your lower hand. If you get it right, it should snap to a halt just before it hits them. When you watch experts like Block and Caruto do this, it's a marvelous, energetic whirlwind, very much in the style of the movies. Caruto, short and stocky, moves like a Jedi Tasmanian devil. But when I look at myself in the mirror, trying to remember whether attack three or attack four is on the left or the right, I don't see a Jedi. I see Jizle Raza. Jizle Raza is probably the best-known figure in the world whose name almost nobody knows. In November 2002, he was a heavyset 14-year-old attending St. Joseph Seminary, a private school in Trois-Rivières, Quebec. There was a school play coming up, and Raza was directing a Star Wars skit. He needed to work on some moves for the actors. Raza was also in the school AV club. So one day he grabbed a golf ball retriever, took a VHS tape with an old basketball game on it, and decided to record his lightsaber moves. The retriever was too long to act as anything other than a double-headed lightsaber, of the kind that martial arts expert Ray Park wields as Darth Maul in Episode 1. Very advanced moves, in other words. Raza didn't care. He would swing the retriever around for about 20 seconds, huffing and grunting with serious purpose, then stop, pause the video, and try again. In his final pass, he got so animated, he almost fell over. In total, Raza recorded 1 minute and 48 seconds. "I was just goofing around," Raza told Canada's Maclean's magazine in his one and only interview on the subject, 11 years later. "Most 14-year-old boys would do something similar in that situation, maybe more gracefully." Raza put the video back on the shelf and thought nothing more of it until the following April, when he found a friend in the AV club had taken a still from the practice footage and was using it as his desktop background image. "There's a video doing the rounds," the friend explained. "Didn't you know?" One classmate had found the VHS tape. Another transferred it to digital format. A third posted it on the web. Right away, Raza got a sinking feeling, but he had no idea how bad it was going to get. It's hard to estimate how many people have seen the video, now universally known as Star Wars Kid. Visit it on YouTube today, and you'll see it has racked up almost 29 million views, adding a million views every 6 months or so. But Star Wars Kid went viral in May 2003, 2 years before YouTube was even founded. The video did the rounds on the now-defunct file-sharing service Kazaa, where it was downloaded a million times in its first month. It hit the nascent blogosphere, which was hungry for just this sort of quirky content. A popular website called waxy.org posted it, alongside a version with Raza swinging the saber at super speed, and from then on, it was shared by email. The New York Times did a story. Parodies aired on Family Guy and Arrested Development. Today, the remixes are almost as popular as the original. In Drunken Jedi, 13 million views, a special effects company called Calvis Corp turned Raza's golf ball retriever into a real lightsaber and showed it fending off blaster fire. There are versions showing Raza battling Yoda, 4 million views, and Agent Smith from The Matrix, 2 million views. In November 2006, a marketing company called The Viral Factory estimated that Star Wars Kid had been seen 900 million times in its first 3 years. That would make it the second most popular internet video of all time, behind only Psy's Monster 2013 hit Gangnam Style. By 2014, it seems fair to say that Star Wars Kid, in its many forms, has been seen at least a billion times. In other words, as many times as all tickets sold for all Star Wars movies. Raza went through some very dark times. So many reporters called after the New York Times story that the family had to unplug the phone. At school, students clambered onto tabletops to imitate him. The crueler side of the internet was out in force. A commenter called him a pox on humanity. More than one suggested he commit suicide. He never considered it, but couldn't help but feel worthless. He did his exams in a high school affiliated with a local hospital, sparking rumors that he'd been sent to a psychiatric ward. His family hired a lawyer that sued the three kids responsible for uploading the video. They sought damages of $160,000, but the settlement they got didn't even cover the lawyer's costs. Raza got his school life on track with the help of a private tutor and was able to return to St. Joseph's Seminary for his senior year. He studied law at McGill University and became the president of a local conservation society. He decided to speak out against cyberbullying after another Canadian teen committed suicide when pictures of her rape were posted on the internet by her accused rapists. A truly horrific case that rather put Raza's experience in perspective. His message for kids who fall victim to cyberbullying: you'll survive. You're not alone. You are surrounded by people who love you. You have to overcome your shame and get help. It was entirely understandable that Raza was as mortified as he was. What he never quite appreciated or cared about was that he had a posse. As soon as the video went viral, before the New York Times had even written about it, far more readers were apologizing for the behavior of the minority. Waxy.org got remorseful and helped organize donations to Raza as a way to apologize. The blog asked for enough to buy him an iPod. 135 readers.